So here's another thing from our random basket of fun topics this weekend. But as I said last night, I think the way that all of my thoughts always tend toward thinking of the family as the center of the society. And, a family is the center of society. And there have been a lot of major trends that contribute to destroying the family, I'm sure you're all very much aware. And one of the things that I hear a lot when I talk about the schools are so bad, a lot of parents feel trapped into sending their kids to the schools, and part of that is for the financial reasons. And there are some real financial reasons, and there aren't. And families really need just practical help in learning how to get out of debt, manage their money, prioritize their spending. And we're talking about nitty-gritty stuff, and that's something that I think every single church, social institution, you know, should be providing and encouraging people to do, because the financial literacy is kind of like the screens, you know. It seems like it's a small thing, but it's such an undergirding for so many other behaviors and attitudes. And so it's the same thing with this talk, with basically how men and women get together and try to make families and support themselves. And there's a lot of money reasons that isn't the case. And that's also true about the reason for our school problems. People feel dependent on putting their kids in a free public school, even though they're nervous about the consequences. And even though, so national polling shows that the plurality is when you have like a poll breakdown and there's no one answer that gets more than 50%, but the biggest answer is called the plurality. So it's something like 45% of parents wish that they could put their kids in a private school, you know, and only something like 8 to 10% of parents actually do. So obviously massive gap between desire and outcome. And then again, I don't think that every family needs other families to help them out with things, like I was talking about with my Broomer Brigade. We need churches, we need other institutions, co-ops of people to help us achieve those goals like that. And so financial literacy and making good financial decisions ahead of time is a huge undergirding way of setting kids, young people free to form families and then take really good care about them. And so there are a lot of factors in our economy that are putting pressure on the ability of families to provide for their kids and just hold things together with money. And I firmly believe when we married, we had negative money. When we had our first two kids, we had still negative money because we had college loans. So I know what it's like to be like, okay, I'm still buying the chicken because the hamburger is $2 a pound and chicken is 99 cents, right? So, I know how that goes. But just by the fact of being married, we were able to knock out our college debt in 2 years. Right? So you hear about people who are 40 and they still have all these loans, and we had the average amount of loans that young people have still nowadays when they come. A third of young people come out of college debt-free still. I don't think a lot of people know that because they're thinking, oh my gosh, it's here. It is possible. You know, I think people really need to think about these cultural economic factors and how they affect and the messages that we're sending kids about how they grew up and what their priorities should be in life, because it absolutely affects whether they can do things like be free to put their kids in a school that won't give them, you know, child pornography when they're, you know, transgender picture books when they're 4 years old. And families need to be free to do that. And so in order for all of those different little interlinking dominoes to fall into place, we as conservatives need to be culturally conservative and communicating to young people how to keep their lives in order and helping them do that and giving very good guidance about growing up and becoming young adults and handling their lives. And we obviously are failing to do that because, and I'm going to talk about some, you know, just show, you probably can think of that from your own experience, and I'm again going to put some numbers to it. How many of you have seen, since the Golden Globes, there have been a number of actresses who have been standing up and thanking by name abortion for their career success. At the Golden Globes, it was Michelle Williams. Just this week, it was a lady I've never heard of because I don't do entertainment. But her name, an actress who is a parent, she's got some 300 million followers on Twitter, so she must be a big deal. Or 300,000, I think. 300 million is the population of the country. That could be right. Anyway, but so her name is Busy Phillips, and she went and testified before the House this week at the behest of Democrats. Are you laughing because you know who that is, and I have no idea? But she testified before the House today in support of an abortion bill, saying that she could not have had a successful career without abortion. She said she had one when she was 15, and because of her infertility, that infertility allowed her to be successful. And obviously, I'm of the opinion that you don't need to, well, I call it spray your womb with Raid, to be successful as a career. I'm here, I've got a baby, I've got other babies. You know, there are ways that people can work it out. So it really is insulting to me. First of all, just because, I mean, I think that abortion is murder. And so if any time you say, I needed murder in order to get a Golden Globe, you should rethink your priorities. But I think our society, it has that kind of mentality, although that is a really strong illustration of it. But we also have that mentality in a lot of smaller ways. And we basically are telling many, many young women today that you can't, you know, that a family and a career are competition, and you should pick the career over the family. And I don't think that competition is necessary. I think codependence and flexibility is possible. But women especially, and even young men, are not presented with the options, the alternatives to sterility and mass murder. So I think we need to be doing more presenting of alternatives to sterility and mass murder. So it's my belief that our current economy is anti-family. And I also think that the sexes are interdependent. So feminism, it basically, in my mind, the definition of feminism is pitting women against men as if we are in a struggle. But I don't think that men and women, we're not in a competition, we're in a cooperation. We need each other. Men need what women have, women need what men have. And so if men are not doing well, then women are not going to be doing well, and vice versa. If women are not doing well, then men are not going to be doing well. So where feminism tries to create this war between the sexes, I believe in mutual help, comfort, consolation, because we're all in cooperation between the sexes. So that's kind of my definition for what feminist means and why that's creating that war between men and women is hurting both of us and all of us, and especially our children. So let's take a look at some of the trends that I mentioned that to illustrate why marriage and family and children are really not doing very well right now. The first thing to be aware of is that women are working more and marrying less. So we have created competition between, and again, I always have to include this disclaimer because it's offensive to people. I am a working mother. I believe, you know, I don't have any problem with women working, but I do think that women and men need more understanding about what children need, and they need to be set free from, for example, crushing student, you know, loans, and better able to care for the children. And put, I think the children should be the priority, not personal glory, success, and money. So, I just think that's what a humane person in society does, is put the kids first. And we really don't put the kids first, we put ourselves first. And I know that's true because I want to do it all the time. So it's way, way easier, honestly, to do my job than it is to be a mother. It's a lot of hard, very demanding work to be a good mom, and it's way easier to, honestly, to write speeches and travel places and put on a dress than to be home with a vomiting kid for 3 weeks in a row, which actually happened this year. So women are being told that, you know, that the career should trump their family, and they are listening to that cultural advice. So if the Department of Labor, for example, recently announced that in the United States, women are the majority of non-farm payroll employees. That has only happened once before in 2010, during a historically severe recession that hit men especially hard. So again, I don't have a problem with women working, but if you assume that, you know, it is good for kids to be with their mothers, and we'll talk about that later, and that we want to have children. The fact that there are more women working than there are men working, and there's also evidence that a lot of men who are able-bodied, working-aged, there's a huge drop-off in their work, That statistic of more women than men in the workforce is actually not really a triumph. It signals that there's something wrong, that women are being asked to carry a dual burden, that, you know, their husbands, or they should have husbands, you know, to care for while they are focusing on taking care of the family. And in fact, this switch in a woman-driven workforce is led by growth in government-driven jobs. Number one, education and healthcare. Those are the two growing sectors of our economy, and you also might be aware of the fact that they're also heavily government-driven, debt-fueled growth. So it's kind of, that growth is a very, I worry about the health of that kind of growth in those sectors, given that there's so much bloat in regulation and so many high costs and very poor returns to them. You're probably all aware, right now we have a record low birth rate during an economic boom. This is another completely different thing. This is total fertility. It goes back on the bottom there to the 1930s through past the 2010s, so at the beginning 1930s. As you see, there's the baby boom right there in the 50s and 60s. Plummets in the 70s, and then, you know, we're back to 1970s, 60s, 70s. So we're back to sexual revolution level birth rates, which is like 1.7 per woman, which is below replacement rate, by the way. So that means if this continues, we're going to have fewer native-born Americans than the generation before them because of how few babies Americans are having. And this is happening all over the Western world. It's actually, and lots of people are worried about it for reasons I'll talk about in a little bit. So here's another one. And so, yeah, U.S. fertility hit an all-time historic low in 2018 and 2016. Just let you look at that slide. And the highest, this was an interesting thing to me. The highest reduction in birth rates was in blue states. Now, births decline everywhere except in North Dakota. Good job, North Dakota, until 2017. But you can see, you know, what we would call blue states, you know, progressive, led by Democrats for a long time. They tend to be the people who are losing the most amount of babies, but it's also happening in red states. It's not just a blue state trend. And so what is contributing to I will talk about in a little bit. I mean, if you don't understand right away why it's a problem that we're not having enough babies to replace ourselves, I'll give a little information about that in a little bit. But first, I just kind of want to give you an understanding of the trends. So, and one of the number one reason that we don't have a lot of kids is because people aren't getting married. You know, the thing that people do is get married and have kids. And so if you don't get married, you often don't have kids. And so the number one reason that we're having fewer kids is actually changes, it's because many fewer people are marrying. I mentioned yesterday, millennial generation, only 20% of us are married. That's one in five. And millennials, as I also said, we're getting kind of old. we're not like 19. I'm not saying, you know, we're not like 16, 17, 18, 19-year-olds. You know, we're 25 through 42-year-olds. So that's, you know, we should mostly, I mean, and that's a historic change. I think it's actually every single other generation has been majority married at this point in our lives. So it's a big shift for our generation and younger. So I have a quote here from a sociologist that is saying, you know, basically all of the decline in fertility since 2001 can be explained by changes in the marital composition of the population, as you see in this slide here. And the other really interesting thing here is that, for me, this isn't because women don't want kids, which is great. Women really want to have kids, but we're not having the kids that we want. So this graph shows the percentage of women who are having fewer kids than they want, and this is on the bottom, it shows their ages and whether they're married or not married. Basically, all women of all marital statuses and all ages that are in the orange bar territory, which is they're having fewer kids than they want. The green bars are the ones who have more kids than they want. That would be me. But I'm completely atypical. Basically all, I mean, so this isn't women hate children and don't want to have them, which is a great, healthy thing to see. This is we want children, and for some reason, we're not having the children that we want. So what was really great about that is that means we don't have to persuade people to want children. We have to make it more possible for them to achieve the children that they themselves already want. Okay. Actually, I'll do that next. Okay. So then the question is, so if marriage is the reason that people are, and lack of marriage is the reason that people aren't having the kids that they want, what is killing marriage? Well, there's a lot, you know, of course, that's a big question. There's a lot of reasons for that. But one of them is culture. Women absolutely feel pressured to prioritize work because creating homes, children, and families is not valued either economically or socially. And that's where, I mean, I think that's where I think the actress is talking about how abortion contributes to their success absolutely is one kind of canary in the coal mine. It indicates that this is our wider cultural message, that to women, you are more valuable when you're getting a globe than if you're having a baby. You're more valuable if you are on some TV show, you have a wildly successful career, than if you're a mother having a child. And that's a completely destructive mentality. For, you know, not just, you know, for the women, because most of us are not going to be actresses who are winning Golden Globes. So, I mean, you know, 99.9% of us are going to be, if we follow the cultural mantra, we're going to be trying to be the actresses winning the Golden Globes and failing not only to get that, you know, and failing to get the baby along the way and also failing to get the Golden Globe. So it's kind of lose-lose proposition, asking us to try to do something, to sacrifice something that we can do that gives us great joy and that, you know, makes society run, all for the pursuit of something that we'll never really have. So it's really like a cheap trick on women to be communicating this to them. And there's other ways, there's other illustrations of the cultural push for this as well. I recently read an article about Iowa businesses. So there's a number of Metro is funny because it's, you know, Midwestern state. So Metro in Iowa is like, you know, my Metro, which is a tiny city. But anyway, but they're growing gangbusters. They're, you know, having a lot of economic development, doing really great. And so they're trying to recruit really great workers, which is all great for them. But the article that was talking about this was saying that the difficulties that new employers in the area, what they're doing is building daycares along with building their new plants, because they are recruiting women and telling them that literally that you need to put your kid in daycare in order to work for us. So again, they're saying that the price of your professional advancement is your family and your fertility. And I don't think that, again, women should be told you have to be barren in order to receive social plaudits. For example, there was recently, and I think the publication was Vox, it's one of these lefties, kind of like the Federalist, only, you know, progressive left. There was an article by a young woman who was explaining why she aborted her child because she didn't have maternity leave. literally, that was her reasoning. She had started her job. You know, she hadn't been there, I think, for the full year to get all of her benefits to kick in before she got pregnant. So, and she didn't want to be putting her career on pause for a couple of years in order to take care of her baby. So she just decided she was going to kill the baby instead of take a responsibility for a human being that she created. So anyway, I think it's pretty obvious that this is the cultural message that women are given. I also don't think, especially like on the business, so for example, the Iowa, on the business right, the message is reinforced rather than attacked, that women have to sacrifice kids in order to be seen as having value in society. So we have to give up something that is essentially feminine. You know, this is what our bodies naturally do when they're healthy. It's not a bad thing. you know, you have to stop being a woman, basically, in order for society to say, you're valued, good job, you go, girl. Well, I think that's completely anti-woman, and it should be embarrassing people. But instead, for example, in the Iowa case, the female Iowa Republican governor was out there talking about how the state was going to help these businesses build and fund daycares for women. If you look at, you know, Congress and the federal government, Ivanka Trump, she's always out there saying how, you know, trying to create paid leave and other government programs for children that have been shown to detach children from their mothers. So these are all kind of ways that our culture and our leaders of our culture tell women that you have to be a man in order for us to think that you have worth and value. Okay, so that's one of the reasons that I think that is killing marriage and kid, literally killing kids. And another one is student debt. So, I mean, let's see here. I mean, the levels of student debt right now, I think, are overblown. As I mentioned in my introduction, you can get out of college without debt still. You just have to actually care about doing so. You don't have to go to college. There are a lot of really great pre-professional, technical, you know, vocational programs that can lead to very high careers that I'm planning to encourage my sons to consider when they're of age. And you can make a very great family-sustaining income without having to go into that. In fact, often earning while you learn and work. You know, so there are ways that people can do it, but people are often not given good information about those options or given the reason why they might want to do that. And so therefore, we do have the largest indebted, you know, a student debt load in American history. And when you have that payment coming out of your paycheck, it reduces your ability to do things like, oh, you know, mom, you know, oh my goodness, well, we have a baby. Well, you know, we can manage this. We have a little bit of flex in our income. The flex is all taken up by a fixed payment for something that happened before. And the other thing is that, you know, encouraging people to go to college, especially if they don't have a really good specific reason for knowing how it will benefit them or it will be paid for, also, it kind of locks women into work as the definition for what their future, basically during their best childbearing years, are going to be like. So the demographer Wendy Wang wrote for the Institute of Family Studies that while education is a proxy for earning capacity, it also is an indication of a woman's intention to work. And a college education is, after all, largely an investment in one's future ability to make money. And I do think that a college education can be a valuable thing regardless of whether it gives you a huge high-priced job. The kind of education that I got at Hillsdale, I think, is a wonderful one for creating a woman who would be a great mother because you have a lot of mental resources available to develop wonderful children. But I don't think you should pursue that sort of thing at the expense of having a huge debt load that works against your ability to have kids. You kind of have to weigh those things in mind. And it is harder for women because we have babies, and it takes a lot of work to take care of those babies, but you don't know if you're going to find a guy and be able to have those babies. So the variables that we're looking at are a lot more complicated than, you know, with a young man. For a young man, the adulthood trajectory is a lot simpler. For women, it's a lot more complicated. And rather than talking through that complication with women and giving them ideas about their options and kind of working out the scenarios with them, instead women are just told, just be like a man, and that's obviously not very helpful to us because we aren't men. Okay, another thing that is killing marriages, maybe surprisingly, is that old age welfare programs such as Social Security and Medicare are actually proven to reduce family sizes. People are less likely to have kids to basically help take care of them in their old years. And a lot of research has proven that pensions, government programs for the elderly, did directly reduce fertility and childbearing. But the problem with this is that obviously money can't buy you love. All of our entitlement programs are bankrupt. And so both of those things actually, so we basically are telling people, you know, encouraging them to do something that destabilizes their elderly years, both financially, but also socially, because who's going to go with you to those doctor appointments? Who's going to check that you're getting the right medications and that the doctor didn't test you for the same thing twice or whatever? Who's going to drive you when it's hard for you to drive? Well, kids and family would be kind of helpful for that. But if you hadn't had those kids and family 60 years ago, then they're not available for you to be there when you're old, and you do need more than money once you get there. Okay, and then here is another huge problem that's suppressing marriage, is the lack of marriageable men. So, yes, we are going to talk about this. So Kay Himowitz, who is a scholar for the Manhattan Institute, says, of course, women being the ones who bear and nurse the children will continue to prefer men who earn at least as much as they do. The gender revolution has not given us rising fertility rates, but the opposite. And the groups that have the lowest proportion of marriageable men are the ones whose fertility rates have declined the most. So this is where I want to talk about. There we go. Okay. This is where I want to talk about men who are, we do have a serious man problem. maybe it does or does not include any of the men sitting here. But we all know, I know personally, you know, family and friends who, you know, there are young men who ought to be perfectly fine and jumping into life, and they're really not. And that's not just an anomaly, it's a widespread social thing. So let me put some data on that. So one of these, not only are there more women in the workforce now than men, there are more women earning college degrees than men. And again, this wouldn't be such a big problem if it didn't literally mean that, you know, men are working less, which we'll talk about a little bit here. But you can see, you know, every generation that we have alive right now, we actually, you know, so the men are the bottom bar, women are the bottom bar. So it used to be until Gen Xers that more men got college degrees than women, which would make sense if you assume, you know, the family model of an economy where the man supports the family that he creates while the wife creates helps create that family. But now we have millennial women outstripping by a very large amount men in a degree attainment. And this isn't just bachelor's degree. This is all, women are dominating at every single level of all, you know, master's degrees, professional degrees, doctorates. And again, I love female achievement, but this is, but the story that we're seeing underneath female achievement is not that the sexes are, you know, mutually dependent and they're having a great time and nobody cares about what's happening. What we're seeing is actually that men are literally falling behind. And so while I want women to do well, I also want men to do well. So let's talk about the man crisis. We actually, this is, anyway, I think this is a shocking statistic. We have fewer working, lower percentages of working age, able-bodied men in the workforce now than during the Great Depression. We're talking Great Depression. We're talking breadlines. There were more men working and bringing home a paycheck and out there even looking for work because, you know, the unemployment rate measures people who are looking. A lot of the men who are in this category are hidden by the fact that we don't talk about the fact that most of the men who have dropped out of the workforce who are able-bodied and working age, they aren't even looking for work. So they don't show up in the statistic that we hear the most. So if you look at it another way, here's a graph showing the not in labor force rates for men ages 25 to 54 from 1965 to 2019. It's now just below 12% of men in those age ranges are not working, and a very large number of them are not looking for work. This is, you know, 1 in 10 of every working age man. What are they doing? Well, actually, a lot of them are playing video games. I'm not kidding. There's been there's research showing a direct link between what these men are not doing instead of work is playing video games in their mom's basements. But there's other things going on. There's the opioid crisis. There's the lack of expectation that you marry a woman that you're having sex with, so they're living off their girlfriends who have a job or have welfare. And there are a lot of them. So they're basically living off of productive people who are not expecting them to get out and be productive. And so what kind of woman wants to marry a man like that? Not very many. So this is another one of the things that is hurting the marriage rate. So all of these factors go into something that I was going to talk about again, how this all of this is creating a crisis, a problem for society. And the first thing that I want to talk about is how separation from parents really hurts kids and therefore society. So I am going to talk about non-parent care for very little kids to emphasize why it's really important that once they have babies, the babies need their mothers. And we all know this, I think, intuitively. But I know, I mean, from talking to other young mothers, a lot of moms, they say, look, I mean, we, healthcare, I mean, I actually didn't include something hurting marriage is, you know, and childbearing is healthcare explosion in costs. But that is absolutely a factor in family finances. So did you know, for example, that the average amount now that is coming out of an employee's paycheck for a family, health insurance, $25,000 a year. I mean, that is almost a full-time job just to pay for the family to have health insurance. I mean, as you all know, we're talking about also often with deductibles of $5,000, $10,000, $12,000. So the rise of health costs is sucking so much money out of earning income that a daddy could make. You know, so you're saying, oh, so maybe a daddy's, I don't know, making the national average right now for household income is $55,000 a year. That's actually, whether that is really low or really high depends on the cost of living where you are. Where I live in Fort Wayne, you could take care of a family fine on that. When we lived in Washington, D.C., we would be poor people, you know, living on that. So it depends on where you live. But the point being that it would make a major difference if, the daddy could earn, 55 plus 25 is 60, $80,000 a year. You know, if the health insurance wasn't being sucked out of his paycheck just to maybe cover his kids in case they get run over by a bus. You know, so that is something that's absolutely taking away from Allie's family's earning power and ability to support a family on one paycheck. Okay. And the problem, of course, with all of this is making more pressure on women, both economically and socially, to be working regardless of what age their kids are. But the problem with that is little children really do need their mothers. I mean, that's just the plain truth. And a lot of people don't want to believe this because, well, we have a lot of guilt involved. And that's okay. I know what it's like to feel guilty for working as a mom. But I also think that in the interest of the kids, we have to be able to face the facts clear-eyed so that we can try to do our best that we can with the knowledge of the facts. So, for example, I have a friend who was abandoned by her husband, and she has a little boy. And so, therefore, she has to work to pay their bills. And her little boy, the father did this when the little boy was 5 years old. So this when the little boy is going to school in half day at kindergarten. So she needed to work a full-time job, and she couldn't be there with her little boy, all the afternoons of the week. Absolutely there are people in situations like that, and I don't want to sit there and say, okay, now you're hopeless, there's no hope for you. I think there's a lot of ways that people can creatively solve that problem. But in order to creatively solve that problem, we have to understand what's really good for kids. So the long story short is that little boy goes home with friends after school every single day, and he's part of their family, and takes care of them. So he had been in a daycare center, but he switched to the family, and he is doing a lot better, and a lot of the things that I'm going to talk about. So I'm not saying, you can't just go to that mom and be like, undo the fact that your husband abandoned you. She can't do that, right? But there are ways that, her child is in a good place. He's being taken care of by a family. And that's because of people valuing the family situation for a child. And they need to know, that is something that kids need. And it is something that kids need. So I'm going to go through a lot of, and again, the reason I go through all of this is because it's completely counter-narrative. Nobody has ever told this. I was never told this. And it's really, it really complicates politicians and corporations' desire to separate kids from their parents and just stick the kids in what I can, mainly call an orphanage. But I think kids need to be, and the research and common sense really shows that the more family-like a situation you can put a child in, the better things are for him. So this is a study that found, studies find this over and over again. So here's one illustration. These are looking at four-year-olds. And right in the bottom is how many hours a week the kids were in non-maternal childcare, so with someone besides their mother. And on the right-hand side for you is less than 10 hours, then 10 to 29, 30 to 45, and more than 45. So it's very obvious, the more time, these are four-year-olds, so we're not even talking about babies. The curve is much stronger for babies because they are much more dependent. So four-year-olds, preschoolers, they're more likely to be aggressive, defiant, depressed, have bad social skills, be troublesome kids, directly correlated with the amount of time they spend away from their mothers. We also find, here's another study that talks about basically how being around their parents is really good for kids' language skills as well as their aggression and their fighting and their conflict problems. So if you look, let's see, on your left is the graph for what kids were like, and this is preschool, first, third, fifth, and sixth grade. So these are bigger kids. Again, this isn't even just babies. The more that they were in non-parent care, externalizing is problem behavior. Hitting, biting, fighting, crying in a corner, all of those sad things. And over here is conflict. So, and then here in the middle is their social skills. So you see very clearly high emotional and physical, violence and disturbance, and poor social skills from being in non-parent care. And then you see over there, this is what kids are like with their parenting. You see externalizing conflict way down. They're much more well-adjusted, and their social skills are much, much better. It's very, very clear. I have piles and piles of data about this, and I bring this out all the time because every time Republicans come up with some new way of having government care for kids instead of their families, I get mad. And it's because I look at research like this all the time, and I think, You know, kids just, they're not like little widgets. They're not even like, I mean, puppies, you know, people hire, I have a brother who lives in Brooklyn. He's like your classic yuppie. And he has a dog. And he hires someone to play with his puppy in the middle of the day because his puppy's sad if nobody shows up, you know, and we don't even treat children with that, you know, amount of respect, which I think is just abominable. But, I mean, if you look at all kinds of, you know, and this is for babies and for a daycare, my favorite one is, I'll mention the Quebec child care program. Here we go. But study after study that nobody wants to listen to has found with very large, you know, studying tens of thousands of children, it finds things that you see reflected in these graphs here, that there's increases in distress. There's also increases in and poorer social skills, poorer coping skills, as well as health. So, for example, little babies in daycare are massively more likely to have ear infections. You know, and again, it's just an ear infection, but like an ear infection for a baby it's extremely painful. He's not with his mother and he's sad, and, you know, and then if you're going to do that three times as much as, you know what I mean, it's needless suffering for the child sometimes. And so why would we do that to children? When we don't even treat dogs that way. So I'll just mention information from the Quebec daycare program, but there are many, many other large looks at kids that find repeatedly exactly what I'm telling you here, and they're completely ignored and brushed over, and instead people will talk about these boutique daycare programs that were done on a total of less than 300 kids in the 1970s, and they had better outcomes for the kids slightly, you know, versus these large randomized controlled trials of 20,000, 50,000, even 100,000 kids showing these negative effects. Instead, we hear about the 300 kids in a wraparound program where they came from a ghetto neighborhood and, you know, they're often being abused at home versus, you know, average, you know, American parent, you know, American family where newsflash, average American parents aren't abusive. You know, the effects on our kids of daycare are much more negative. Anyway, so I'll just illustrate with the Quebec information, which I think is very striking, but it's not isolated is the point of that little rant. In 2000, and so 20 years ago, the province of Quebec instituted it didn't start with birth, it started with pre-K, and then it moved down to birth after a couple of years. And now it is a birth to school, or even after school, daycare program, government run and subsidized. in fact, it's not necessarily, they don't have government centers, but it's basically like a voucher system, so they give people money, they subsidize kids being in daycare so more moms can work. So it was actually expanded to babies in 2000. And so among the things that were found over, so they follow this study, longitudinal study, so we have outcomes from these kids for 20 plus years, and they are very bad. First of all, I mean, they increased daycare use by one-third, which isn't surprising, and it also moved children out of more family and informal arrangements and into more center-based care, which is worse for the kids. The more you can get closer to, you know, being a family situation, whether it's a relative or, you know, a neighbor or whatever, that's much better for the kids if they need care, like the little boy I mentioned. So a 2005 study of the program found striking evidence that children's outcomes have worsened since the program was introduced. We also find suggestive evidence that families we study become more stressed with the introduction of the program. If you live in a dual-income family like we do, you understand that intuitively. This is manifest when the children increased aggressiveness and anxiety, and more hostile, less consistent parenting for the adults, and worse adult mental health and relationship satisfaction. So it's stressing out the marriages of the families that have provided this government service. And so a follow-up study in 2014 found the estimates indicate that on average, children who gain access to subsidized childcare at earlier ages experience significantly larger negative impacts on motor social developmental scores. So their development is lower and worse than the kids who weren't in the program. Self-reported health status and behavioral outcomes, including physical aggression and emotional anxiety. So that mirrors what I mentioned about these other studies earlier. A 2015 study on the program found its negative effects on non-cognitive skills appear to strongly persist into school years. Non-cognitive skills is social skills, negotiation, conflict resolution, falling into tears, at any instance of problem, just being unable to handle your life. And in many instances, these problems grow larger as the children get older. Problems such as anxiety, aggression, and hyperactivity were worse in older children than in younger ones. So even after they're out of the program, their problems are getting worse as a result of having participated. Moreover, there was a worsening of both health and life satisfaction among the older children who had been in the program. And then the most striking thing to me, the study found a 3.7 increase in crime among children who participated. So obviously the conclusion of all this is we don't need more depressed, criminal, upset children and stressed out parents. It seems like it's a good thing on the front end because you're taking care of this problem so moms can work, but on the back end, the long-term effects are making society worse for all the rest of us. So this creates what I call, So more working moms of young kids means more daycare, and more daycare means more cost to society for emotionally hungry kids. It's not an investment. It's actually, what's the opposite of an investment? An investment that loses you all your money on the stock market. I'll talk about this later, but really my goal is to make it, I think that policy should, to the extent that it can, should make it more possible for more families to care for their own children. And so ways to do that would be, well, making health costs go down, making higher education cost less and be less required for everything under the sun, and creating social conditions where we support and encourage mothers and we affirm the work that they're doing and we affirm that we love that they're women and that women make babies and that babies are great and you're doing a great job contributing to our society. All of those sorts of things are kind of ways of reversing all these problems that are making families stressed out and sad and stripping them of money in the process. So this is creating, oh, yes. By the way, the young people's suicide rate is going up. I'm sure there's lots of reasons for that. As I mentioned yesterday, it is also correlated with screen time. But, what are unparented kids more likely to do beyond their screens? Generation Z is one of the least mentally stable, the least mentally stable generation yet. If you have read things about colleges are swamped with kids needing mental health services. The snowflakes that you've heard about, that's a real thing. It's not just a couple of crazy wacko kids. And since we know that that's correlated with mother absence, I wouldn't say that all of it is correlated with mother absence, but I would say, some of this, I am sure, is related to it because we just have an increase in mothers being away from their children. And mothers being away from their children makes them sadder and have more trouble, and that's exactly what we're seeing as we have increases of mothers. Mothers away from their kids in the early developmental years. So what does this all mean? It means more people in the cart and fewer pushing it. Which, great. That's just what we need right now. So I'm going to combine all of this talking about the weakening of our economy and the family structure upholding the economy with the fact that we have already a giant welfare state. So every single person who has a proposal for a new big government program has to wrestle. So of course we have all the Democratic candidates trotting across the screen telling us about how they're basically planning to socialize everything. More government, more government. We can't even afford the government we already have. our Social Security and Medicare programs are in very dire need of help. And they are projected in just 6 years, there is going to be a 25% across the board cut to Medicare if Congress doesn't do anything. That's because there will be not enough money going in to fund all the things that will be coming out 6 years from now. And that's going to happen for Social Security in at least 15 years, although probably it's going to happen sooner because of our deficits. So you can see here, based on that, this chart shows the ratio of people pushing the cart, paying taxes, versus people taking out of sitting in the cart, using the money that the taxes provide. And so it starts up here on your left from 1940. And on the right kind of combines them, which I think is helpful. And so youth dependency is like people who are, the taxpayers are paying basically to educate, and there's a lot of Medicaid in there too. So these are government programs for young people plus government programs for old people. And it shows that we're in 2020, 64% of our population are taxpayer dependents. One third, two thirds of the people in the country are taking more out than they're putting back in terms of just taxes. This is projected to be 3/4 of the country by 2060. And in fact, almost 3/4 by 2030, that's 10 years from now. So obviously, we're gonna need a lot of smart, well-parented children to be able to be working in 10 to 20 years to be able to be paying taxes and solving these problems. And all of these stressors to family life that make them less likely to be able to do that are happening at the same time. We're gonna have to have a greater draw upon this generation's financial and emotional stability. This is what I call a perfect storm. This is not happening just in the United States. This is happening globally. So then the reason that it matters that it's happening globally is the way that a lot of advanced countries are trying to solve the problem of the low birth rate is they're importing people from the third world, where they are having more kids than now. But the problem with that is that the third world birth rates are also declining, and all of the world's giant economies are competing for those people. And so first of all, just in terms of numbers, there are not enough poor brown people to come into our welfare states and pay for the old white people for their welfare states. But the other problem with that is, of course, you know, being from another country, they're a third world, they don't have good education, they don't have very good language skills, so they're not coming in, again, you know, at a high economic productivity level to be able to sustain all the payments they're going to be asked to. I mean, they're going to be, it's basically importing an underclass. So that's not good for them, and it's not going to solve this financial problem that we have set up for us as well. So we have a mental instability increase and economic skills decrease. Again, this relates also to Common Core, right? We're depriving our kids of an excellent education at the very moment we need them to have the best freaking education we can get, you know, them to have by the time they move into the workforce. And so this next generation is deprived of mental and financial abilities. While they're also smaller in numbers because we're having fewer of them, but they're expected to carry a larger demographic and government burden than any generation in U.S. history. Yeah, right. We have a big problem. So, now I'm going to talk about a couple of things that I think would help with this problem. I honestly don't know. I mean, I think we're going to all feel some pain is pretty much what I think all of these graphs are showing. But I think, I mean, again, what do? When you see pain coming? Well, you try to reduce the impact, you try to ameliorate it. And I think a lot of the ideas that are being floated in our state legislatures and in Congress are ideas that actually would make the problem worse. There are ideas that would separate mothers from children, that would increase costs for families, you know, that would make more people take on more college debt. So they're pretty much, from both Republicans and Democrats, you know, all of their ideas are going to make this problem I outlined worse because they basically want to double down on all the stressors creating this problem. So obviously we don't want to do that, and we need to educate them about why. You know, when we were talking with them. So what we really need is, again, we need for our economy to be family-centered and mutually beneficial, reinforcing rather than separating men, women, and children, and focusing on cooperation rather than competition. So something that I like to think about that I use as a mental model for thinking about what a better economy would look like, and one that's focused on families and not pitting men and women and children against each other and having them all kind of like, you know, sucking off each other like leeches, but all giving to each other and loving each other and serving each other. I think about the pre-industrial economy, because something that I say often to my husband is, you know, women have always worked, right? If you think about like a farming family, you know, women were contributing. I mean, yes, we're having kids, but we're, I mean, if you ever read the, you know, Little House on the Prairie books, Ma Ingalls is a beast, right? She's having, you know, she is raising her kids and with them and teaching them, but she's also, you know, feeding a whole family, canning all the food that she needs for the winter, growing a massive garden, milking the cow. You know, she's basically holding down a full-time job, you know, that, but her full-time job is directly contributing to the sustenance of the family. And it's in a family integrated in a close to her children way. She's not separated from the children while she's also economically providing for them and for her husband. And so the industrial age is what really did, and fathers were the same way, right? They were home around their families. You know, if Pa was out in the field and he had a rotten little boy who was being bad to his mother at home, Junior was along with him hoeing in the dirt and where Daddy could keep an eye on him, right? That's not something a lot of daddies can do nowadays, take a stinky Junior to work with him when he's creating problems for Mom. Or just apprenticing the child to him, you know, and teaching him how to take care of himself. So then when the industrial economy, putting people to factories, separated people from their local communities, and it separated families from each other. And I think actually what we're seeing in a post-industrial age is more opportunities for, I mean, obviously we're not going to go back to growing all of our own food and milking all of our own cows. Some people do that, but I don't think that's realistic for, you know, for most Americans. But what I do think is realistic is to encourage more integration of family and work. So, for example, and the reason that this is so obvious to me is because I basically do it, right? So I work, you know, I work from home. I'm around my little kids. We have a baby come in, a sitter come in from 6 to 8 hours a week in the afternoon. And the other amount of the time, the kids are cared for by mom and dad. You know, and the babysitters are young, are college-age teenage girls from church that they know and they see, you know, at church all the time. And they're basically like family. You know, so that is possible because I don't have to go into an office. I bring my babies with me. I mean, literally, when I have little babies, you know, their bassinet is in my office. You know, I nurse while I type. You know, so oh, maybe I shouldn't have revealed that, but it's true. I've probably gotten like a third of my, you know, work life stuff done nursing. The baby doesn't care. Baby's happy, right? One-handed. It's awesome. But that's only possible, right, because I don't have to go into an office. So, you know, baby and mommy can be next to each other doing all the stuff that we do. And I also have, you know, my kids can come knock on my office door when they're crying and they just need mommy and the babysitter doesn't cut it. You know, there they are with their little face on my window and we go get a hug and it's, you know, so, and I do that on purpose. So the ability of for being home with my kids and available to them while also still being economically productive is a huge boon, both, you know, to our you know, for, to our family life, and also, you know, to our ability to pay for our kids to go to private school, you know, and make sure that they have shoes on their feet and things. So, and I think that more people, there are more opportunities for more women to be able to do that, and data really shows, I mean, women don't actually really want to put their kids in daycare and be in the workforce. Many, many women are pressured into doing that because they don't have any other better options. So one of the things that I think we need to be encouraging our governments to do is make that more possible by deregulating. So there are a lot of, for example, a lot of the we have industrial age rules for an information age economy. And, you know, we have government regulations, labor, you know, bureau things that push people into, for example, defining 40 hours as full time or forcing people to give health insurance to people when they hit 30 hours. So it really makes flexible part-time home, you know, or I can go to work. So I, for example, my doctors that our family goes to, they hire a lot of women that they're nurses, you know, they're nurse practitioners, whatever the case may be. They come in 2 afternoons a week, right? So they're there from 1 to 6, you know, 2 afternoons a week. So their little person is with grandma for 2 afternoons a week. You know, and then you're not having the, so the mom is still able to have a job that she enjoys. She's using her professional skills, and her kids are in really good hands. So government needs to get out of the way of more arrangements like that. And we need to have more, you know, I think public forums talking about these ideas and encouraging, you know, businesses to look at them if they really want to, because I think the way that businesses often try to be woman friendly is really by saying we hate women. And so saying, we're going to build you a daycare instead of, yeah, your baby can be, you know, next to you at work. Oh, sure. Oh, okay. You've been working us for 3 years and you're about to have a baby. We would be happy. You can go to part-time, you know, and work flexibly as much as that's possible. I know a lot of, for example, lawyers and accountants, you know, who are able to do that. So, but people need to have more visibility of that and more talking, and then, you know, less government forcing workers and jobs and workplaces into the 9-to-5 man slot. The benefits of this kind of type slot, and because all of that makes all of that more expensive, and it also makes it harder for families to have kids at the same time as they're working. Another thing that I think we really need to do as a culture is to just reaffirm that men and women are different and we like both of them. That's one of the things I think relates to that's one way I think feminism and transgenderism kind of overlap is in their denial of the essentialness and the difference of man and woman. Feminism says, you know, if you want to get ahead, if you want to be respected, if you want to achieve, you have to give up one of the things that makes you uniquely woman, your womb, right? You have to act like you're a man and that you have an unbroken career that never, you know, is never has any flexibility, never accommodates children. You're going to work 9-to-5 and you're going to college, you know, right out of high school, la, 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 la. Women are more complicated than that, as many of us know. So rather than being said, we don't like how complicated you women are, maybe we could be told, you know, women are complicated, and that's beautiful. We have lots of options to help you be able to figure out how you're going to manage your education and your career and your family and piece those puzzles together on your own timetable. And we really value the skills and the work that you have. And the last thing that I really think is that one of the things that I always wish that churches and community institutions would do is be really good networking locations for people to solve human problems like this. So where a single mom can say, look, I'm a single mom. I have these kids, you know, I need to provide for them. And someone to say to them, look, we love you enough that we're going to make sure we find a great family for your kids to come home to. Someone who's going to offer love and treat you like you're part of our church family. Rather than just saying, okay, you know, saying nothing, not thinking about the fact that that's going on in your community. And then allowing people to have, I don't need that anymore. And then leaving those needs unanswered and then creating this desperation, this demand for government to step in and solve the problem when a family and a church in a neighborhood could step in and solve the problem in a much better and more humane way so those children really get the face-to-face and loving care that they deserve. And one component of that is states need to deregulate their daycare regulations. So just one quick thing. Some states, for example, say if you do what I mentioned my friend does, have her little boy go home with kids after school, then you automatically qualify as a daycare, even if you're just like a family having a friend's kid come home. And you have to have state inspectors come, and you have to get a license, and you have to have your snacks approved by the FDA, you know, and all of that. Like, you know, if the mom is happy with a family that her child is going to, that's her business. You know, so that's one way that government can get out of the way and help people take care of each other's needs. All right. I'm set with that. Open. Are we doing questions?
What do you think of this lady? I'm going to take a couple of questions, but before we do, let me ask you a question. Have you ever read the 45 Goals of the Communist Party?
I have, but it's been a while.
How many of you have read the 45 Goals of the Communist Party? Put your hand in the air. Why would I mention that? I believe the greatest threat to America is cultural Marxism. Nothing else is close. Interestingly enough, one of those goals is getting the kids
away from the parents.
You also talked about homosexuality in general terms. That's another one of the goals. The communists believe, and this comes from a study, this isn't just random stuff, that homosexuality was the best tool that could possibly be used to break down our culture. This was in the 60s, okay? So I encourage you, those are on our website, or you can Google them. Take a few minutes. I'll bet you, Scott, yeah, you've read them. The other thing I wanted to mention was, you know, just a question to the audience. How many of you would like to hear more from Joy? We just set the trap.
This is what my kids actually tell me too, which is very surprising.
You know, you're going to do something. You're going fishing Sunday afternoon? Oh, no. What are you doing Sunday afternoon?
I'll be at Mount Olive Lutheran Church in Billings talking about how to create a Christian culture for your kids, 4 p.m.
4 p.m.
But to the public.
So all of you that clapped and raised your hands should be there.
Mm-hmm.
Right. We're going to take a couple of questions, but before we do, thank you for coming.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Thank you for showing up. I'm always amazed.
Yeah,
anyway,
it's
such an honor to have anyone.
I scold and I'm nasty.
To listen to your rant for 4 hours.
But now we're going to take a couple of questions, but I want to demonstrate what I mean by a question. It would be like something like, what color are your husband's eyes?
Brown.
Not my life history, and then the question. So seriously, questions, not rant. So there's a gentleman over here that I cut off. He gets the first question. And we're recording this again for those of you that aren't listening. This is already going to be on our website.
to them for questions if you don't mind. I know you can't see me, but I'll just try to talk louder.
Thank you. And thank you for coming. I find your concept of a parallel society to be very intriguing. Do you have a recommendation for a particularly a national organization that we can research to learn more about it and perhaps financially support?
Well, no, because I came up with it. Well, I was about to say came up with it myself, but actually it is influenced by, anyone who's aware of the fellow named Vaclav Havel? He was an anti-communist leader in Ukraine who later became, when the Ukraine became a free country free of communist rule, he became one of its presidents. And so during the time, he was part of the communist resistance in Ukraine while they were ruled by communists. And he has written a number of essays and he has a lot of speeches. And one of them is talking about parallel institutions. So this was parallel society or institutions was an anti-communist resistance tactic used by the underground. And it did actually start with education because they saw, you know, that one of the number one ways to separate children from their families mentally is to control what they're taught. And in communism, people who have lived under communist societies come to America and look at our education system, and I have heard them do this, and are amazed that, I mean, we're not aware of how powerful education is for propagandizing the next generation. I mean, it is one of the number one tools used by communist states and totalitarian states for all of time. This goes back to, the French Revolution. Who was it, was it Rousseau who said, give me a child at 4 years old and I'll have him, for the rest of his life. And that is largely, that there's a lot of truth in that. I mean, I don't think it's a done deal, but it's higher than, than 50% accuracy. So the point, so that is when I started thinking about that as some, and especially when I, the Common Core journey that I went on, as I mentioned earlier, made me really lose faith, like a lot of Americans have, in our ability of our current public institutions to repair themselves. It seems like, people work their rear ends off. They throw all their time, money, and effort into trying to fix something, and it can often take them many years out of their lives, and they still lose. And that's, again, not all the time, but there is a very high failure rate that is extremely discouraging. So I started thinking, and when I went through the Common Core, core battle, I thought about that for my kids, and I was like, okay, trying to get state legislators to fix it didn't work. Trying to get the federal government to address this hasn't worked. Congress has only been making things worse for, since the 1950s. You go through the entire list of possible people, and I came down to myself, and I had actually been in a lot of private schools that, a lot of private Catholic and non-Catholic schools adopted Common Core as well, early adopters, because the people who lead and teach in private schools are often trained by, the same institutions that teach the teachers in public education institutions. So I can't, so I'm like, okay, teachers' colleges are awash. They've been ideological propaganda centers for decades. I'm left with like me and my church, literally. So I was like, babe, you should start a school. And that's literally what we did. We said our kids have to go somewhere. We personally think that if you can, I had also a part of my NOVAC fellowship. I visited a number of schools around the country, some that were doing Common Core, some that were not, to kind of compare and contrast and try to get and to see what it looks like in the schools. So that's in my book as well. Because I think it's really important for these abstract concepts like Common Core, for you to take and be like, okay, what does this look like in a classroom? What are the ideas, the philosophy, how does it affect kids? Anyway, so I looked at a really high-performing Common Core school and a very high-performing non-Common Core school, and then I've been in average public school classrooms to kind of get that distinction. Anyway, all that to say, going to the very, very good non-Common Core schools, and it's kind of like where I was, I was homeschooled and then I went to Hillsdale. When you look at what that amazing excellence is, we just had such a hunger that our kids would be able to access that. And so we knew that we could homeschool them just fine, but we thought that a very good school would be something above that level. So basically our answer was, well, we're just going to put, you know, we're going to do the Nehemiah thing. We're going to have our sword, and I'm going to be the politics lady. My husband's the trowel, you know, and he's building up this little school for our kids. And so far, you know, every single year we have doubled in enrollment. Now, we started with 5 kids. It was like a homeschool classroom. Next year it was 10. Next year it was 20. This year we're already on track to have, we have 35 already, and, you know, it's not the end of enrollment season, so we're probably going to double again. So I think people, I mean, I just did that because I was so dang frustrated, and I knew that yelling at my state board of education, even if I did that for 20 years, my kids are all going to be grown in 20 years. It won't help them any. And so I do think we need to do that for the sake of the 95% of kids who are in those kinds of schools. But I also think, like, we need better options than having these kids imprisoned in places that obviously don't have their best interests at heart. So that's why I care about the economy, right? That's why I care about families being able to provide for themselves. And I think, and I also get really, really sick. I'm almost done. But I have, also, being in conservative politics, I see so many people like ranting at the television, and they just like sit on their behinds. I mean, this probably drives Dick crazy. I can tell. You know, like, you know, people just it's. We complain about the left being virtue signalers, but we're virtue signalers too. You know, we're often as much of a hypocrite. So it's like, okay, I've really turned into a, so if you see a problem, what are you going to do about it? You know, really don't complain at me unless you're really going to do something about it, because I'm just, I mean, I've been hearing, I was about to say boomers, poor boomers. You know, because there's some really, really great ones. My dad is a boomer. My uncles are, you know, they're wonderful. Anyway, but like, this whole performative sort of, oh, I'm going to get real mad and send money to a think tank that puts out a white paper, I'm done with that. Like, it doesn't work.
We probably have time for 2 more questions.
All right. Anyway, so I'm just like, okay, well, my new philosophy is I'm going to be the little red hen. I'm going to do it myself. We'll see if I collapse. So far, we're all right. But because I think things may be as bad, or they may get as bad as, I mean, I don't think communism coming. I was like, well, Bernie Sanders is the front runner. Okay, you know, our country is in a dangerous enough position that I think we need to be thinking about contingency plans and stop trusting systems that have been failing us for a century. Okay.
Joy, 2 things. One, your references to Nehemiah and your name remind me of one of the most significant verses in the whole Bible, is that when Ezra the priest says, let the joy of the Lord be your strength. So there's the action, and there's also prayer and resting on God. I wanted to ask you, though, your editor at The Federalist, what is The Federalist? Is it an online magazine? Is it a print magazine? How can we subscribe to get more of this?
Oh, yes. That's an, do you mean the newsletter sign-up sheet?
We have a sign-up sheet in the back that you wanted.
Oh. Great. Okay. Boy, you guys are very, very good at running conferences. Thank you. Yeah, The Federalist is basically an online, it's a relatively new startup publication with a bunch of people who were sick of George Bush type of republicanism. And they were also sick of a lot of the conservative outlets running cover for that kind of conservatism that does a lot of this, oh, you know, what Republican politicians do, complain about stuff and then go let Democrats steamroll them, you know. So I was hired on there a couple of months after they started up. That's got to be like 5 or 6 years ago now. And we are now the top visited news site on the right. You go to thefederalist.com. There's a free email newsletter. You can, there's a little sign up for it on the front page, and it'll give you all of our stories every day. And this lady over here.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, there is a sign up sheet if you want to be on her.
Yes.
So, all I can say is if you want to be The Federalist,
and if you want to kind of follow up on where the things that I'm doing, I mentioned yesterday the work I'm doing on the tech, I'm going to turn into an ebook and like a habits transformation guide for families. And I also have, you know, a book of recommended picture books for families for kids, because that's one of the simplest things to replace tech time with. And it is a really great relationship builder with your kids, and people don't know where to start, and there's lots of crap on the shelves. So those are some, but yeah, so those are ways that you can kind of follow me or kind of follow up after the conference, and they're on the table in the back. Yes.
I got here a little late, so please forgive me if you covered this and maybe I missed it. But I'm curious, has there been any data on men raising the children in the family? I know a few families were doing that, not a lot, but a few where the woman is working, the man is at home. I'm just wondering if we know anything about how that is for children.
There's not a lot because there aren't that many men. We actually have done that for part of our marriage, and we have a couple of friends who have done that just because that was what was available for us as an option to not have our kids in daycare for a couple of years. And then and then my husband went back to grad school with the goal of, you know, shifting over to him, you know, being full-time, which he is, but he's still in startup mode. But then my goal is to switch to part-time after, you know, we're able to do that financially. But so we have personal experience with that, and I know that, for example, the data I'm aware of says something like 20% of men say they would be willing to be a stay-at-home parent, but there's not a lot of information about, how that affects the baby, you know, depending on how little the baby is. I do know that, and I've known a couple of families that have done this, and they can make it work, but the dad isn't as tends to be even. And my husband's a really thoughtful, caring, nurturing kind of person. But he's not. She's just not a woman, you know. So he's not like what I would call like a rough and tumble, like, you know, mean, hard edged man. But like there's still a very obvious difference. So I mean, I know that family care is better for kids than non-family care. And obviously a daddy is family, he cares about the child. But they're also, it is better, you know, if you can do it. Little babies prefer their mothers. The baby's attached to the mother from the womb, so the baby can hear my voice now. The baby and I have different, we have cells inside each other's bodies we have exchanged our own DNA, and they'll be inside each other's body for the rest of our lives. The baby is used to like my habits of motion throughout the day. You know, just physiologically, the baby he needs me, you know, when he comes out. And I mean, of course, daddy loves the baby and will do better, you know, than a stranger. But I mean, I think it's probably likely that, you know, just basic biology, the best would be for the mommy if the baby can get it.
You are a great audience. And thank you for coming. I want to mention to you that things for Del Tackett sign up are in the back. Put McDowell on your calendar. I should explain how this works, right? I don't think people understand how a calendar works. All people don't have calendars. Oh, I would love to have done that, but put it on your calendar now. If you can help us pay for this, we'll check in our little box in the back. Blessings to you. Thank you for coming.